Well, if you have a Bible on a device or a hard copy, if you'd like to turn to Matthew 12, we're going to be spending some time there together today. And some fantastic stuff that God's going to speak to us about through his word. About 2,000 years ago, Jesus and a bunch of his followers are walking along a road that was going through some grain fields. And the guys with Jesus are feeling a bit peckish. And so they pick a few heads of grain as they're walking past, and they chew on them for a while. And some religious leaders who are watching them get really, really angry at them. Picture yourself in the scene. You're just walking along. You're feeling hungry. You see something that's edible on the side of the road. You just grab it, shove it in your mouth, and you chew it. And somebody's gotten really, really angry at you. And today, 2,000 years later, on the other side of the world, we're going to talk about that incident. And it's kind of a bit strange. Like, how could something so innocuous as some guys walking down a track, picking a bit of food and eating it, become something that can make a difference to our lives today? Well, it actually speaks to the nature of work and rest and the rhythms of life that is still stuff that we need to think about and can make a massive difference to our lives today. So today we're thinking about Sabbath rest out of Matthew chapter 12, God's design for our flourishing. How long do you reckon the week has been in existence in the way that we do it? You know, 5 days of school if you're at school, and then 2 days for the weekend. How long do you reckon that's been around for? Guess what? It's only since about the 1940s. Hard to believe, isn't it? Because that's all I've ever known. But apparently it's only since the 1940s that we've had what we call the week, you know, the working week, and then the weekend. Going back through history, there's some interesting ways that people have kind of ordered their weeks. For example, in ancient Rome, they had this eight-day week where every eighth day was a market day. And so kids who were fortunate enough to go to school, who were in the suitable class that they had that privilege, they went to school for 7 days, and then the eighth day they had a day off. Similarly, if you were working, you would normally work for 7 days, and then on the eighth day you'd go into town, you'd participate in the markets. If you were a farmer, you'd bring all your produce. If you weren't a farmer, you'd go and buy what the farmers brought. So that was their eight-day weekly rhythm. Then the French Revolution, and kids, if you thought 7 days in a row of school was tough, and teachers as well, what about in the French Revolution? They decided to kick off the shackles of the past and organize their week into 10 days so that there were 3 weeks per month. And so they would work for 9 days and then have 1 day off. That's even a bit rougher, isn't it? But then in the Soviet Union, similarly, after a bit of a revolution, they decided to reorganize their week, and they were really trying to maximize their production. They were trying to compete with the United States as a global power, and so they wanted their factories going around the clock. And so what they did was, instead of having a standard week where everyone worked at the same time and rested at the same time, they had, if you were a worker, you were given a number between 1 and 5. And they had a 5-day working week, but the day that you had off depended on what number you were allocated. So everyone was kind of having days off at different times to try and keep the cogs of machinery turning in the country. It didn't last long, only worked that way for a few years in the 1930s under Stalin, and then they gave up on the thing because it just wasn't really working for them. So I guess this raises the question, if there's just a little sampling of how different cultures at different times in history have organized their weeks to try and make life work for their community, life work for their country, life work for themselves as individuals. So what should a good week look like? What kind of rhythm has God designed for us? And like I opened with, you know, when I grew up, I kind of was more used to the idea of a 5 and 2 rhythm, where I went to school for 5 days. Then we had 1 day, which was for fun. That was Saturday. You went off and did picnics and played sport and did whatever you wanted to do. And then the Sunday, that was a day devoted to worship. Anyone else grow up in a kind of a culture like that? Yeah, many of you. That's not what my kids are growing up with. The week now looks quite different to how it was when I was growing up. We still have, you know, the 5 days, and then we have the weekend. But, you know, people's work follows very different schedules. Our leisure time on the weekend follows very, very different schedules. We shop on Sundays, which was a big no-no back when I was growing up. So our week has changed a lot in the last 30 years. And is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? What does a good week look like? And that's the cool thing about where we're up to in the Gospel of Matthew. I don't know if you remember where we got to last week, but Jesus had just said these words, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. What's Jesus saying? Come to me, let me teach you the rhythms of life. Let me teach you how to live. And there might be a part of you that resists against my yoke, and you might want to go your own way, but take my yoke upon you. Take my guidance on you. Follow the path that I've set for you and the path that I lead you on, and you will discover that my way works best. You'll find rest for your souls that you will never find when you just try make your own way in life. So as much as in ancient Rome and in after the French Revolution and in the Soviet Union, people were kind of trying to make their own weekly rhythms work, has God said something to us about how a week should operate, what our rhythm of work and rest should be like? And if he has said something to us, what are we doing in order to make that a reality in our lives so that we can be blessed by it? The cool thing, as soon as Jesus says these words in Matthew 11, the very next topic that we see talked about is this topic of the Sabbath. It's the story that I just recounted to you of his followers getting into a bit of trouble because they weren't keeping the Sabbath the way that the religious leaders thought they should. So before we dive into the story, let's find out a bit about what that weekly rhythm was supposed to be like, what the expectations were of this thing called the Sabbath, so we can find out how Jesus deals with this controversy. What is the Sabbath? Well, according to the Bible, God himself has prescribed a rhythm of life. We don't need to think about, what's a good rhythm? Is it 10 days? Is it 5 days? Is it 8 days? According to the Bible, God actually, in the very act of creating, set up a rhythm for creation. This is how it's described in Genesis, at the end of Genesis chapter 1 and the beginning of Genesis chapter 2. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. There was evening and there was morning the sixth day. And chapter 2 begins, thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. I love the way that it describes it because the universe is massive, isn't it? And when you look at what God created even on this planet, I mean, it's just so intricate and massive scale and also really tiny scale. When God created, he did a mountain of work. And the story continues, by the seventh day, God had finished the work that he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. So the seventh day, which, by the way, wasn't the seventh day for Adam and Eve, was it? It was their first full day as human beings, because they were created during the sixth day. So on the seventh day of creation, on the seventh day that God was active in this world, and the first day for human beings, God rested from his work of creating. And so the question I want to pose to you is, why do you reckon he did that? Why would God stop his creative work on the seventh day? Bless that day, make it holy, make that day special. Was he worn out? Because when I think about how immense creation is, and I think about how intricate it is, and I think about how much thought and creative energy and raw power must have gone into creating the universe and this planet and human beings and the animals and all that stuff that went on, I mean, you think that's a mountain of work. But the Bible tells us it didn't weary God at all. In fact, the Bible tells us God does not grow weary and faint. So it wasn't because of tiredness. Now, on the end of the first 5 days, you get to the end of the day and God looks at what he has made. Day one, day two, day three, day four, day five. And what does he say? This is good. He looks around and he's satisfied with what he has made. And he gets to the end of the sixth day. And what does he say? When he looks at all that he has made and surveys it, including the pinnacle of his creation, human beings made in his own image. And he says, this is very, very good. He's enjoying it. He's pleased with what he's made. And so the seventh day seems to have more a flavor of stopping to enjoy what he has made. And that seems to be the pattern that he is embedding in creation. When you skip forward to the next book of the Bible, the book of Exodus, in the story as it's progressing, God has created a nation through which he is going to bless the whole world. This nation is going to represent him to the world. And it's meant to operate by his ways. And as he has rescued the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt, as he's sending them into the promised land which he was going to give them, he's setting them up with the way that he wants them to live. And a key part of it that we read about in the Ten Commandments and in numerous other passages in Exodus and in Leviticus in particular, he's talking to them about this Sabbath rest, the idea that they too are meant to take a rest on the seventh day, to cease from their normal activity and enjoy being the community of God with one another. But like many other parts of God's law, unfortunately over time, the principle of the Sabbath, it was a time to stop your regular activity in order to enjoy the goodness of God and all that he has made, that was a little bit lost. And it became just a more of a symbolic, legalistic kind of thing. And by the time you get to the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah 58, we read these words, where God says through Isaiah, "If you keep your feet from breaking the Sabbath and from doing as you please on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the Lord's holy day honorable, and if you honor it by not going your own way and not doing as you please or speaking idle words, then you will find your joy in the Lord. And I will cause you to ride on the heights of the land and to feast on the inheritance of your father Jacob. The mouth of the Lord has spoken." I hope you hear God's invitation there. He's saying to the people of Israel, keep the Sabbath holy. It'll be a delight to you. It's not meant to just be something you do to prove that you take me seriously, something you have to put up with because that way you'll show me that I'm important, more important than these other things. No, it's actually a gift to you to delight in. As a community, it's a time for you to rejoice in God and what he's done for you, a time to experience that special blessedness of a rhythm of life that is really good to us, that's been built into creation. So way back in Isaiah 58, we see God saying, hey, don't do whatever you feel like doing. And don't do what you think you need to do in order to get by in life. Listen to me when I speak to you about how to live and follow my ways, and you will find rest. You will find flourishing. And that sounds an awful lot like what Jesus has just said in Matthew 11. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Learn from me, take my yoke upon you. There's an invitation that we are being given by Jesus that echoes the invitation that God gave the people of Israel. But straight after giving this invitation, this is what happens. We'll read the story from the scriptures in Matthew chapter 12. And if you've got it in your own Bibles, follow along there as well. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what's unlawful on the Sabbath." Now, by the way, when the Pharisees used the words unlawful, they didn't necessarily mean unlawful according to what God had recorded in the Bible. They were really saying unlawful according to the centuries of traditions they had built up about how you should obey the Bible. And Jesus can see that they've lost sight of really what God had said about the Sabbath and what it was meant to be like. And for sure, God was really serious about it. They were to not do any work, and God prescribed very serious consequences for working on his special day. But the reason he was serious about it seems to have been lost over time. So Jesus tears down their legalistic fault finding with this retort. He answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple desecrate the day and yet are innocent?" And you might look at that and say, what is going on here? What's he speaking about? So Jesus is reminding these Pharisees, these guys who know the scriptures well, that there was a time when King David, a hero of Jewish history, clearly broke God's law. He was desperate. He and his men were hungry, a little bit like Jesus' disciples were hungry when they picked those heads of grain. But David was so hungry that he went even a step further. He went in and took bread that in God's law was specifically designated for the priest. Nobody else was to eat it. And David gave that bread to his men. And Jesus is pointing out this story because God didn't condemn David. He didn't punish David. God was aware of all of the what was going on in the situation and the reality of David's heart, and God chose to be merciful and forgive David, even though David unequivocally, undoubtedly, he broke God's law. Yet God chose not to punish, not to condemn. God chose to be merciful and forgive. And Jesus also reminds these Pharisees that God has also got the right to make exceptions to his law. So God made laws about the Sabbath, and he was really clear and very strong about how important the Sabbath was. But yet he also set up systems for the priests where they needed to continue their work on the Sabbath because worship was integral to what the Sabbath was about, and the priests had the job of facilitating that worship. So they didn't get the Sabbath in the same way that others did. And so Jesus is pointing out in this reply that God has the authority, even when people break his laws, which are clear, to show mercy to people. And God has the authority to declare when there are exceptions to the rules that he makes, as these two situations make clear. So if God himself can make exceptions to his own rules, and if God can forgive people who even break his rules, what does Jesus then go on to say? I tell you that someone greater than the temple is here. And if you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. But this is the kicker in verse 8. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Who has the right to forgive people who break God's laws? No human being. God does. Who has the right to declare when there's an exception? Where the law doesn't apply in a particular circumstance. None of us do, but God does. And Jesus is clearly saying, that's who I am. You're talking to the Lord of the Sabbath. You're talking to the one who has this authority to both forgive when people do the wrong thing and to make exceptions when it's appropriate. No other human being has ever had that level of authority. And these Pharisees claim to love God's law, but loving God and loving people go hand in hand. And they use the law to condemn others while making themselves look righteous. In so doing, they condemned people that God viewed as innocent. And who had the authority to declare them innocent? Jesus. Because he's Lord of the Sabbath. He is God. And to really drive home this idea, another story follows on from this confrontation. From verse 9 we read, going on from that place, he went into their synagogue. And a man with a shriveled hand was there. And looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And again, in their minds, they're thinking, Jesus regularly goes around healing people. If he heals somebody on the Sabbath, he's continuing his regular work. He's breaking the rules. We'll be able to nail him. So Jesus says to them, if any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then he said to the man, stretch out your hand. So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. So once again, Jesus, in his authority as God, declares what fits with God's law, what doesn't, what suits the purpose of the Sabbath, and what doesn't fit with the Sabbath. And he shows that God's heart for the Sabbath is to be a blessing to people, not a burden to be borne. So let's bring this home to our lives today. See, a lot of us read stories like this, and we look at the Pharisees and say, oh, those guys. And we don't want to be like them. We don't want to be all legalistic and rule keepers and people who point the finger at other people. And so when we think about the Sabbath, we don't want to be in that same position of saying to people, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that and you're doing wrong. We don't want to have that same condemning attitude. And that's right. We shouldn't be like that. But we also need to see what else Jesus was doing in this story. He's not wanting to encourage that self-righteous, critical attitude that looks at the behavior of others and saying, you guys aren't measuring up, you're not doing it right. But at the same time, he doesn't want us to miss the blessing that is being offered to us by God. Jesus is helping to connect us with a rhythm of life that God has built into the fabric of creation. You see, nowhere does Jesus say the Sabbath isn't important anymore. Nowhere does he say that we don't need to rest and be refreshed by God. Nowhere does he say that, you know, getting together with a community of other believers in order to worship God, well, that's not such a priority anymore. In fact, the Old and New Testaments urge us to be careful not to let the stuff of this life get in the way of the good things that God wants to do through this weekly rhythm that God offers us. And I've got to say, right off the bat, that I have a terrible track record when it comes to the biblical principle of Sabbath. Because a bit like the priests in the Old Testament, who, you know, they were working on the day that most people were having their Sabbath, so they had to figure out a different way of having that healthy rhythm in their lives. And it's the same for me. I do what I regularly do on the Sabbath. It's kind of my peak work day, if you like. So I've needed to find rhythms of life where I can do my rest and spending time celebrating God and stopping what I normally do at another point in the week. And I've not gone well all the time, and I'm very sobered by listening to stories from other ministers who have shared their experiences of burnout, and inevitably what they tell me is that they needed to learn this rhythm of rest. And it was going to look different from many of the people in their congregations. And you may be in a similar situation, whatever your work situation or family situation or whatever else it might be that's going on for you. You might need to be really thoughtful about, well, what's it supposed to look like in my situation? But there is this healthy rhythm that God has built into nature. So if you're like me and don't find the principle of the Sabbath easy to live out, let's think together about what it might be like, and we'll all be learners together. I'm not standing up here as an expert. I'm just standing up here as somebody who opens the Bible and says, well, clearly God thinks it's pretty important. So let's get our definition of the Sabbath aligned with Scripture. Here's what it is. A Sabbath is where we cease our regular activity in order to enjoy God and all that he has made. So I'm not standing up and saying, well, you need to have one day a week where you don't watch telly and don't play sport and don't do this and don't do that and don't do that, although that may be some of what it's entailed for you. But what it is important. It's where we cease our regular activity in order to enjoy God and all God has made. It's meant to be a delightful day for us. In some traditions, there's two candles which are lit on a Sabbath. And in some cases, it's a Sunday. In Jewish communities, it's a Saturday. And one candle represents ceasing. Now, what am I going to stop today so that I can be refreshed? And the other candle represents celebrating. What are some things that I can do today that I don't do on other days of the week, but they will really help me to tune into the presence of God in my life and to celebrate his goodness? So if that's what the Sabbath is, we're ceasing regular activity so that we can enjoy God and all he's made, let's imagine what that could look like for ourselves. For me, one of the big ways that I get refreshed by God is to get out into nature. And this is a photo that M. Arthur took down at Yallingup. And when I was younger, and I'll probably be silly enough to try it again, I used to body surf down there and get dumped and just get carried along under the water. And it was fantastic. Just being out in nature, I find, restores my soul. And there are many, many different ways that people do that. I wonder if, for you, a great way to spend a Sabbath would be to get outside. Maybe like M, it's to take photos. Maybe like me, it's to be dragged along by waves. Maybe you want to get a microscope out and look at the intricacies of a flower that you found in your garden. Or maybe you just want to lie really still in the backyard or in the local park and listen to the birds. But just getting out in nature can have a huge blessing to our soul, especially when we're talking to the one who made it while we're there. So maybe that's a possibility of what Sabbath could look like for you. Maybe listening to music that helps your soul sing to God. When we get together and sing, I always find it hugely uplifting when I sing with my church family. And we try to make sure that there are some different styles so that everyone in our church family can kind of connect and resonate musically as well as in terms of the meaning of those songs. Maybe it's getting together with others to worship God and to grow in him. Maybe it's reading something. I don't know if you're readers, but maybe having a day a week where you read something that is good for your faith. Maybe creating something for fun that you don't normally get to do, where it's not work. You're getting to enjoy the cool things that God has given you to do and really develop that facility in yourself. Maybe it's inviting somebody over for a meal or ringing somebody up who's been missing from church, and it's looking outside of yourself that will really restore your soul. Maybe it's initiating a spiritual conversation with somebody. You could ask somebody in your own family, or maybe somebody who you know from church, hey, how did you come to know Jesus? Hey, what do you think about life after death? Or whatever it might be that will spark a stimulating conversation. You get to chat with your family. What are you most grateful for this week? Alyssa will tell you that I sometimes spring these questions on them in the car and say, oh, Dad, I just want to chill out. But I find that stuff so awesome. What are you grateful for? Hey, what can I pray for you this week? Great opportunity to be refreshed as a family and remember where your life really comes from. Memorizing scripture, having a challenge for your family. Hey, we're going to see if we can learn a passage together over the next week. Maybe going on a secret mission to perform an act of service for somebody that you hope never gets traced back to you. And that's going to be the thing that, you know, you have that cheeky little snicker and you go, ha, ha, ha. Done something good and nobody knows it was me, and it's good for your soul. Maybe taking a nap. I'm a huge fan of naps. Didn't get one today, sucked. Maybe writing a song, a poem, or a journal entry. Watching something uplifting on TV. Not garbage, but something that is actually good for you, a story that helps to engage your faith, inspires you. We're all wired really differently. So the ideas that I've just kind of sprouted out, you might have listened to those and go, I don't like any of them. But what is it going to look like for you? One thing I would really encourage, make a plan before the day starts. See, when you just kind of get to the day like you're crossing the finish line, it's, oh, thank goodness it's Sunday or Friday or whenever your Sabbath day is going to be, you tend to waste the day. So plan ahead of time. Say, you know what? What's going to be really good for my soul? What's going to be good for my family? What's going to help us to focus on God this day and really take advantage of what the day can bring to you? And the other thing I'd really encourage you to do is not give up. Because sometimes, even despite our best efforts and we imagine how awesome the day could be, we actually get to the day and things go wrong and people kind of interrupt your plans or whatever might go on, and you can have a sucky Sabbath. It happens. But it's a little bit like Christmas. We don't cancel Christmas just because one year we had a bad one. We keep going with it. It's all about Jesus, not about us. And we keep persevering. And that brings us to the last thing I want to suggest that we do when it comes to the Sabbath. We need to think about what's going to get in the way of this. Because this thing I know for sure, our enemy, the devil, will do everything he can to make sure that your life is not operating by the healthy rhythm God wants it to. He's going to do everything he can to interrupt your focus on your Creator, the sustainer of your souls. So what will you find it hard to have a break from? If a Sabbath is a break from our usual stuff, in order to really focus on God and to celebrate Him, what are the things that are going to make that really hard for you? Maybe you've just got this compulsion. If I don't check my email every 5 minutes or my social media feed or whatever, I could miss the most important event or whatever. And maybe for you learning to chill out and say life does not revolve around that, it will be a really healthy thing. Maybe you've gotten into a pattern of worrying about a certain thing and you need a day's break from that. And every time that topic or that person comes to mind or that situation or that project at work or whatever it might be comes into your mind, you need to do that self-talk that says, you know what, I'm parking that till tomorrow morning. And you need to give yourself a break from it. Do you trust that God is big enough to make life work if you carve out some space which is just for Him? I think He is. I think that's really the invitation He's giving us. Hey, take my yoke on you. There'll be some times where you go, oh, I really need to go the other way. But no, do what I say is best. It's going to be really good for you. So we are not, as a church family, ever going to get all legalistic and up in each other's business and say, you're not doing it right. But what we are going to do is encourage each other and say, hey, how are we using our day? And for some of us, it might be today, that's your day. And for probably majority of us, that'll be the case. But for others of us, it'll just be different times as it works for us. But that's the point. It's meant to work for us. It's meant to be something that makes our life better. It takes faith in God and self-discipline to actually carve out that space. But when we do, we discover it's life-giving. It worked for God. He set it up as a pattern for us. Let's give it a whirl. Let's see if one day in seven we can order it around God. St. Augustine, many centuries ago, said this. He said, O Lord, and I'll translate it into contemporary English for those of you who can't read the words out. O Lord, you've made us, and our spirits are restless until we rest in you. It's a great thought.